Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about the movies Belfast and Clifford the Big Red Dog. And we're going to start with Belfast. And Mike, what do you want to say about this movie to start off with?
Well, we should talk about it being autobiographical, namely because the director of the film, Kenneth Branagh, grew up in Northern Ireland. He lived there with his family until he was 9 years old, and then they moved to England. And that's very much the story told in, guess what, Belfast. I've got to very quickly say that this is a highly fictionalized story. There's a lot of conflict within the film between Catholics and Protestants, the troubles, if you will, in 1969, which is when the film is set. Branagh's own background wasn't quite as tumultuous, but he certainly knows that material. So it's entirely justified that he would kind of embroider and fictionalize it that way. And I've got to say, to kind of cut to the chase on this, that I had very mixed feelings about the film. I think it's highly uneven in terms of the tone, in terms of the visual qualities and so on. But I've got to acknowledge that it's a crowd pleaser. I saw it in a movie theater where the audience really went for it and some people applauded at the end. So it really does have that kind of audience appeal. Despite whatever flaws I found in it, I got to acknowledge that it works, you know, for audiences, it really works. And it worked for me overall as well. But Marie, let me turn it back to you at this point, because I'd love to get your general reaction to the film.
Well, my first reaction was I was really looking forward to seeing this because, you know, I'm a fan of Kenneth Branagh and I love, you know, origin stories. And I was sort of looking to see how, you know, clues to how this kid grew up to be, you know, one of the best Shakespearean actors and directors of movies based on Shakespeare's plays, which I didn't really feel came across. So it could have been really anybody's story. Having said that, I think what I was responding to initially was comparing it to Roma, also a very nostalgic personal story, which did very well and had beautiful black and white cinematography as well. But somehow this didn't land the same way as Roma did. For me, it seemed more of a generic story than a deeply personal story. What did you think, Mike?
Well, Marie, you make a good comparison there because Roma is a much more consistent film. It really gels. It holds together beautifully and in terms of the visual palette, if you will, in terms of the narrative and so on. Belfast, I think, is a little more of a jumble in terms of how it's put together and how well it works. I want to ask you a question that is both technological and philosophical, so brace yourself. It has to do actually with the use of black and white. Now, I love black and white cinematography, certainly more than many of my students do, but I mean, I just love black and white. So believe me, I'm in that camp. I want that. But it's always a question of, well, when is it appropriate, if that's the way to put it? In other words, most often in contemporary films, when they go to black and white, if they use black and white entirely, or if they go to it by way of like a flashback or something, it's because, well, we're going back in time. You know, we're looking at the childhood of our protagonist, or we're looking at an earlier decade. And so typically, of course, you know, we all know this, they'll go to black and white, or they'll go to a kind of sepia tone, a kind of washed out color, because that's the past, right? Sometimes those burnished golden tones, I thought, did people live that way? Did they have this golden glow around them in the 1930s? But, you know, we think about ways in which films treat the past. Here's my question, which actually kind of troubled me as I watched the film, speaking of the troubles in Northern Ireland. This film is set in 1969. Kenneth Branagh, who would have been around 9 years old himself at that point, he's looking back at his personal past. Should he be looking back at it in black and white? If you're nostalgic for the late 60s, is that a black and white memory? What do you think?
I think that you're right, but I'm with you in that I like black and white. And I think in some ways, it's a good creative choice to make for a couple of reasons I scribbled down while you were asking me that question. One is it gets across a bleak environment because, you know, it's just black and white and gray. You know, there's no color. It gives you a sense of just the desperation. Also, it works as a metaphor of, you know, the black and whiteness. You're either a Protestant or you're a Catholic in what they're talking about here. It also kind of underscores the idea of poverty, you know, like, everything is so bleak and so poor, you can't even afford color. And finally, it sort of evokes that looking back at ancient photographs of the past, which would have been in black and white before color came along. So for those reasons, I think that's why it's so tempting to use black and white for the past, where I think it would have been more effective is if, you know, you jump a little further ahead where that times are happier and you have that sort of Wizard of Oz, you walk through the door and all of a sudden things are in color again. What do you think, Mike, of those ideas for using black and white, and would you add any reasons to those?
Well, you know, Marie, those are all valid reasons, and I thought about them as well. And, you know, ultimately, it is a good-looking film in the sense that, by good-looking, I mean appropriate-looking, that, you know, it is a grim time. But you know what? Within the story, the family circumstances, in terms of the immediate household and so on, are not so grim, actually. It's a loving household. It's not quite as depressed as all that. Secondly, there's quite a bit of pop culture in the film. You know, you've got, like, Van Morrison on the soundtrack. And when they go to the movies, it's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, you know, which is a really joyful kind of sequence, which probably would work for me better in color, if you will. So I kind of went back and forth on that one. And when you mentioned, you know, how they use black and white to go to ancient times, well, 1969, you know, for us at least, you and I speaking, is not so ancient. So I really just sort of wondered, how would it look in color? Now, curiously, I'm sure that Kenneth Branagh thought about all this. He had to. And in fact, there actually is a color sequence, a montage showing the present day city. So he's trying to set up a contrast. And I think, Marie, he essentially would agree with all the very valid points you were making, that, you know, as he thinks back on that period, it is sort of in shades of black, white, and gray. So I think ultimately it's probably justified. So as I was wondering about that, it was just simply on that kind of more generalized level of, you know, when is it suitable, if you will, to use black and white. Now, because I love black and white, I'm tempted to say always, you can always use it. It's fine by me. But you know what I'm getting at, Marie? It has a lot to do with our expectations, our conventions as to when we expect to see it. And I think some audiences might be initially a bit surprised that this film set in the late 60s would be shot in black and white, because that's the way to evoke that period. Because this is, after all, you know, pop culture, which was infiltrating Belfast as much as anywhere else.
Now, I will say, when I saw it in the theater was pretty full as well, and they were all people my age or older. So I think it drew on the crowd that would enjoy watching something very nostalgic. And I will say one more thing about the value of using black and white is that it gives you an idea of a sketch, you know, something you might draw out with a pencil on a piece of paper rather than a photograph that was super realistic. Because, you know, your memories of the past are always kind of sketchy. You know, sort of, you don't remember all the details. You're just trying to, you know, get a general outline of things. So that's why I think black and white works when you're talking about childhood.
Well, you know what? Let me be flip with this question. not my first time being flippant, but when you think back on your childhood, do you think in black and white terms?
You know, I actually have quite a few Polaroid pictures remember how Polaroid used to actually be a thing, which are now, like you had mentioned, sepia colored. So I feel like a lot of the color that is memorialized in photographs I have of my childhood is washed out. And some of the details that I would want to fill in are kind of fuzzy, you know, the further you get away from things. So I think that's why it's not a sharp picture like we would have a video today, you know, that would be in the cloud that you could access. You know, the memorabilia from the past is sort of decaying, and, you know, the colors are washing out of those Polaroids even as they sit there in the photo albums.
Well, you know, you make such a great point about that, because you're absolutely right. You look at photos from that era, specifically Polaroids, and they are washed out. The memories start to get a little fuzzy. And in fact, at some point, they become fictionalized, which is sort of what Kenneth Branagh is doing, too. I mean, your actual childhood, and then as you recall it, those are not always going to match up completely in terms of accuracy. And so I think that's a really interesting observation there. But let me dovetail and tie it into one of your other really interesting points, namely that when I went to see the film, the theater was fairly crowded, and it was mostly an older demographic, to put it in sort of dry terms. And thinking about it that way, I thought, well, yes, this taps into a kind of collective nostalgia. I didn't grow up in Northern Ireland in the late 60s, but there's some points of comparison, or at least of thinking back on one's own childhood that way. And I think that's a large part of the appeal of the film, is that Branagh is successful in immersing us in that period, you know, several decades back. And whether it's pop music on the soundtrack, or the movies they go to see, or what's in the news headlines at that time. And, you know, let's face it, I mean, there's inherent appeal to that, because you go to see a movie to immerse yourself in some other world. And even though it's not your immediate world, unless you grew up in Belfast, there are points of comparison and you feel like you can enjoy it at that level. And that's not necessarily superficial, but those surface pleasures are there. And, you know, to hear all that Van Morrison music, for instance, I mean, it doesn't have to be there. You could, you know, plug in something else, but listening to it, it burnishes, it enhances a lot of scenes that otherwise I think are not always as strong dramatically, narratively, as they might be.
I also enjoyed, because you know, I grew up in the 60s as well, the whole Chitty Chitty Bang Bang thing. I mean, I loved that movie. I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theater when it came out. And that moment of, you know, where you realize, you know, meanwhile, in America, I was probably sitting in a theater watching the same movie, was a nice parallel. Thought that was actually pretty cool. I wanted to ask about a comparison to another movie that I could not stop thinking about while I was watching this, which is Jojo Rabbit, which had a young boy in a tumultuous situation, story told through his eyes and his innocence, but I think done so much better and also in color. What do you think about this movie compared with Jojo Rabbit, which, as far as I know, it's not a true story, but just in terms of telling the story of a young boy living through a tumultuous time and telling that story through his eyes.
Well, you're making a strong point there that when we think about movies we like, how often they have a child protagonist, that the adult, in effect, looking back on his or her own childhood. And then once we're immersed in that earlier period, of course, then we identify with the child, and then it becomes the Bildungsroman. It becomes that sort of coming of age story and those formative experiences. And there's so many great films that do that. I mean, just in another context, academically, I was, talking about Federico Fellini's Amarcord. I remember, one of the great films about childhood. In his case, his memories of fascist Italy. Now, his memories are in brilliant color. Well, that's Fellini, right? He's dreaming in color at that point. But Marie, you and I could list not just Jojo, but a number of films in which really that's the narrative hook. That's really the narrative line that carries us. In this film, to double back on Belfast, it's a 9-year-old character, buddy, who's clearly the Kenneth Branagh surrogate. So we're in his corner. You know what I'm getting at? I mean, we want to identify with the character, and we know it's the director's own childhood. And then doubling, or at this point, maybe tripling back on one of your earlier comments, when you mentioned the fact that, you would probably, as a viewer, knowing that he grows up to become Kenneth Branagh, famous actor slash director, you would want to maybe get some inklings of that in the film itself. And Marie, to me, it seemed like a little bit of a gap, or just left me kind of wondering that I would have thought that Branagh would have planted at least a few scenes where you get some indication of what the adult Branagh would become. So let me throw it back to you at this point, because again, it doesn't necessarily hurt the film. It's just something I found myself thinking about a bit, that most films you would think would plant a few clues, like, ah, he joined his school drama society, or just something along those lines. But what do you think here? To me, it just seems kind of like a gap or an absence that, gee, why isn't there something there of that sort?
Now, there is one thing, but I think it was so small and almost like of all the things to pick. But in one scene, Buddy reads a Thor comic book, and Branagh previously directed Thor 2011, the first film adaptation of the character. But of all things, I mean, I guess it was easy to stick a comic book in as a reference, but something more like, I don't know, even an aside reference to Shakespeare or a Shakespearean play, or that he read one or he didn't like it, or just really literally anything that would have given us a clue that he was even aware of Shakespeare as a child. Although, you know, maybe he wasn't. Maybe it was something he only discovered later and it's not part of the story, but it seems like a miss for people looking for, you know, like you're saying, inklings of the man that he was going to become. But this movie, I don't think, has that much humor. And that's kind of what I liked about Jojo Rabbit, as off center as it was. There was really not a lot of comic relief in this movie. So I don't know how they would have, the ways I was suggesting that they put it in there to give us a clue, might not have worked in the script.
Well, Marie, that Thor reference, when I heard that, it was distracting actually, because when we think about Kenneth Branagh, that's not really his forte. It's not what he's known for. I mean, it should be Shakespeare, or at least, or Murder on the Orient Express or something, where we think Thor was just like a job. It was just like, and now he's in some ways justifying it, like, well, when I was a kid, I read the comic book kind of thing. But in the film, it just seems like a toss-away reference. It seems like a throwaway reference. Not that I want it to be heavy-handed. You don't want a 9-year-old kid to look up at the grim street and say, well, to be or not to be in Belfast. I mean, you don't want something as heavy-handed as the, you don't want that kind of heavy-handedness, but you want to have some inkling that this is going to become a serious actor and director. The Thor reference, yeah, stuff he's reading as a kid and thinking about, but I don't know. It just seems like something sort of tossed into the script, like, well, I should reference it. And well, it lasts a matter of seconds, right? I mean, it's just almost like a do you get it kind of reference. And if you get it, fine. But to me, I thought, no, you want to have something more interwoven there to indicate, you know, it is about a coming of age of a boy growing up. He's not so young. At nine, people start to think a little bit about, you know, what do they enjoy play acting? Do they like to direct? You know, it could just be playing games in the street, but something that would give an indication of where he was headed. How do you feel about that? Because I thought it was actually, you know, the more I think about it, I think it's actually one of the weaknesses in the film is that, as you said earlier in our discussion, there's a generic quality to this film. It doesn't have to be quite so generic. It could have been a little more specific in terms of his own childhood and his formative influences that lead to the adult Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, I think if nothing else, it would have been nice to know whether he was even exposed to Shakespeare. You know, of all cultural references to include, you know, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, like I said, that kind of coincides with my own childhood. That's what I remember watching. But was there ever any Shakespearean, you know, plays put on that he was even aware of where he could have shown like a glimmer of what might interest him when he became a little more mature and sophisticated in his tastes? And I agree with you. I think that is the biggest hole in the story, even because he could have dealt with it by actually showing how unaware he was of Shakespeare. I mean, even just one scene where a reference was made to something like To Be or Not to Be in Belfast, and been saying as a kid, I don't get it, would have been a moment for the audience to say, oh, well, you will. You know, you're actually going to be really well known for this later. But he doesn't include anything like that at all. I think that was, to me, the biggest flaw in the movie.
May I mention another flaw?
Sure.
All right, I will. Another flaw in the film is now he has a really loving family, and it's really cohesive in this. And that dad goes off to work in England sometimes, comes back and so on. But they, you know, they're really a tight-knit family. But the thing that struck me was they live on a street where both Catholics and Protestants have been peacefully coexisting. But as tensions escalate, essentially the activists, the radicals, in effect, are telling the Branagh character's family, you got to choose sides. You know, you're Protestant. You need to stick with us and not be nice to the Catholics, basically. So anyway, without spoiling anything in the actual storyline, by the end of the film, it's going to get to the point where you have to like choose sides or declare that you're not going to, you know, attack your neighbors, basically. But leads up to a finale, and again, without going into the details of it, that has been compared, and I think fairly, to something like High Noon. Like it's sort of like a shootout on the street kind of scene. And that to me, to be really blunt about it, it wasn't that I was partly bothered, I gotta say, by the cinematic reference. It was kind of distracting, you know, High Noon on the streets of Belfast. It was partly that, but secondly, it just seemed to me forced. It just seemed that in the actual staging of it and the dramaturgy of it, it's like you can see the wheels turning. You can see the screenplay kind of, you know, cranking and creaking and turning. And we've got to lead up to a big ending here, dramatic flourish and all that, and the music reflecting that and the camera work and editing. And to me, it just seemed like too much and too, I keep using the word forced, but just like kind of artificial. Like, you know, that the narrative needs something really hyper dramatic at this point and we'll get it. I want to get your thoughts on that because it just seemed to me that, not that that kind of ending couldn't be justified, but here, that near finale scene just seemed to me, again, sort of pushed on us. And technically, as much as thematically, it just seemed like Branagh was kind of giving the heavy push or heavy lift, whatever image you want to use there, to the material. What do you think about that?
I agree completely with that because I feel like it was added in there because he thought he needed an action scene, where I thought most of the drama came from the fact that the character's father was, you know, having to go to London to work, and he was being offered opportunities if he would move the whole family. And of course, everyone is entrenched, you know, in their own neighborhood and their familiar, you know, environment. Nobody else really wants to move. I want to give a shout out to the actor playing the father, who is Jamie Dornan, who, by the way, grew up in Belfast, because we've seen him in other things. I think he's probably the most name brand actor in the movie from The Fall and from 50 Shades of Grey. And I thought he was terrific as the father. In fact, I thought he was the most sympathetic character, far more than the young boy.
You know what, Marie? What carries the picture as much as anything is that it's a solid cast. The actors playing Ma and Pa, the mother and the father, and particularly Jamie Dornan. initially I remember thinking, oh my goodness, it's Christian Grey from 50 Shades of Grey. Speaking of black and white and gray, you know, we're sort of into paint samples at this point. But the more I thought about it, I thought, you know what, you know, he's a gifted actor and that's his best known film, but this is such a different role, to put it mildly. And he's completely immersed in it and he's really good. The other shout out I would give would be to Jude Hill, who plays the 9-year-old kid, our protagonist. Very good child actor. So when you have Ma and Pa and the kid together, those scenes are quiet. They're understated oftentimes, making that finale, that shootout kind of finale, the action sequence seem all the more artificial, because that's not the strength of the picture, that kind of action sequence. The other good performances, or among the other good performances, would be the grandparents. You've got none other than Judi Dench and Ciaran Hinds. And those are just like really enjoyable scenes, just, and again, at that quiet level of just sitting and talking. You don't have to have dramatic fireworks. And that's one reason why I think the film is so uneven. It doesn't quite seem to know which mode works best or which mode to stay in. Not that you can't have both modes, both the reflective and the more vigorous, more active, but you need a kind of strategy. You need a kind of a narrative consistency as to how you're going to handle that. And I felt this film kind of jumped and lurched and was not very consistent with how it handled those changes in mood and tone. And finally, to add another reservation, my third or fourth at this point, there's a kind of cuteness that kicks into a lot of the scenes, which is one reason why, frankly, I think audiences like it. But for my personal taste, sometimes the cuteness goes a little far and just is, you know, kind of cloying. The point for me at which cuteness segues into cloying. And I thought that there were a few scenes that were kind of pandering that way, kind of pulling the narrative strings a bit more than they needed to. The material's inherently heartwarming in terms of this family and what it's up against. I don't think you need to push it that next step and make it like adorably cute. I'm going to get your thoughts on this because it gets into the inconsistent tone of the film and where the tone tends to veer into what I keep calling cuteness.
Yeah, and I think I know what you're referring to. There's a couple of scenes with his cousin, where he's being encouraged to sort of engage in things that his parents are not going to be approving of. Just, you know, kids doing kid stuff. And it's all part of the piece of there's all of this chaos going on in the neighborhood and how it affects the kids and the kinds of things that they end up trying and, you know, participating in. But you're right, there is this sort of cutesy quality to, I don't want to get into too many of the details because I don't want to give anything away, but some of the interaction seems like it's put there for adorableness, deliberate adorableness. But we need to segue into our next movie, which is Clifford the Big Red Dog, speaking of adorableness. But I have to say from the outset that I did not expect a lot from this movie, even though I'm familiar with the books, but I really ended up enjoying this movie a lot more than I thought I would. And if you're not familiar with Clifford the Big Red Dog, the title pretty much gives away the story, but it's a young girl's love for a tiny puppy named Clifford, which makes the dog grow to an enormous size. So the whole point of the movie is that this dog is really big.
Yes, it's a very big dog. Let me give my own response to the film. So much depends on our expectations when we go to the movies. I mean, our personal taste, our expectations. I've got to say, when I went in to see Clifford the Big Red Dog, going to a movie theater to see it, I went in with very low expectations. And friends asked, well, why'd you go to see that? I said, well, I go to the movies and it's a movie, right? So I went to see it. Sometimes I'm even like almost like borderline embarrassed. Like somebody says, well, oh, what'd you go see this weekend? And I was like, I went to see a movie. Well, what movie? Oh, you know, it was a kid's. Well, what was it? Well, all right, Clifford the Big Red Dog. And then moreover, if I had to confess that, you know, I actually kind of liked it, or I liked it more than I thought I would. I think there's some inherent appeal just simply in the story as Marie outlined it there, where you have a, you know, a small girl and she's kind of picked on at school and kind of isolated and this and that. And she comes into possession of a dog, and there's some mysterious and quasi-magical, more than quasi-magical attributes pertaining here. But anyway, essentially the dog responds well to love, so much so that if you love it more, it grows more and it becomes an enormous dog. And so there's just some scenes that are going to be funny because they're funny when you have, you know, this little girl. Oh, well, she's a middle schooler, but you have this girl and then you have this enormous dog trying to fit into a New York apartment. And then just like the street reactions, like when they go out walking or whatever, it's just like, you know, I'm not like knee slapping, you know, ha, 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 but I'm smiling. And you know, it's putting me in a good frame of mind because it's just an appealing fantasy, isn't it? Like if you had a pet and this pet was so big. And also, of course, in terms of the girl growing up, one of the life lessons, and movies like this always have a life lesson, is you need to, you know, be sure of yourself, assert yourself, And it's okay to have a pet that's different, if you will. And so again, for the target audience, for small kids, I think it's a really enjoyable film. You know how I'll put it? It's a film that I think little kids will really like, and their parents will kind of like too. They won't mind so much. They'll be actually be kind of glad they went to see it.
It's worth seeing just for the scene where Clifford, the huge red dog, who, by the way, kind of has a look like my background. He's sort of this plush red velour, almost stuffed animal looking creature, but of course, really, really large. And he's a puppy. So he does puppy things like they go to the park and there's somebody in one of those inflatable ball things. And of course, he sees a ball and just goes after it and chases it all around. And of course, the poor person in it is now being thrown around in a ball by a puppy until he bites it and it deflates. It's very funny sequence. You know it's coming. You can see as soon as you see the inflatable ball, oh, we're going after the ball. But it's funny. It also has that kind of picture book look. And I wanted to mention that, you know, Clifford the Big Red Dog, there's dozens of these books. You know, Clifford Gets a Job, Clifford Takes a Trip, Clifford's Halloween, Clifford's Christmas, you know, Clifford's Hanukkah. You know, they put any situation you have, you know, you can put a huge animal in it and, you know, havoc and mayhem will follow. And that's the story, that and the idea of, but in spite of it all, you know, some people are bigger, some people are different colors, and that's told with the dog in metaphorical ways. Is there anything about the whole Clifford story or imagery, Mike, that I'm neglecting to mention?
No, in fact, you know, in terms of how they present the dog itself, that vividly red hue, there is a kind of storybook quality to it there. And even though the animation is kind of herky-jerky at times, ultimately that didn't bother me as much as I thought it would, because I realized this is coming out of storybook material, and here suddenly is this big red dog. And it's not entirely convincing, but how could it be, right? So when the animation itself I thought was a little awkward at times, there's still a lot of pleasure to be had. It's just fun to watch as this animated dog is going down a real street and with real human characters around it. That blend of live action and animation, you know, works relatively well here. And again, I'm not like a huge fan of this film, but doubling back on my earlier point, when you go in to see a film with low expectations and then it's better than you thought it would be, yes, it makes me smile then, thinking, you know, I'm kind of enjoying this film. And so I tried to be a grouch for a while, but I wasn't grouchy. I was enjoying it.
Now, I will say, because we discussed Jude Hill from the movie Belfast, that I thought Darby Camp did a great job as the young girl. Very modern take on, you know, a kid in a story, much more so than the Belfast story, which of course you're limited by what really happened in that one. But in terms of a storybook character, very strongly written, very well acted, nothing to complain about there. Any parents taking their kids to see this movie who are familiar with the books will love it. And like you said, Mike, most children will enjoy the idea of all the crazy things that can happen if you have an animal that's just bigger than average. You know, you get bigger messes and bigger destruction and all the kinds of things that are fun to watch for kids in a movie. But that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. You can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.